Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang, proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Jeff and Elliot will be tackling Final Frontier from VPG. Jeff will be reviewing The Golden City from Z-Man Games. Plus, we'll talk about the state of role-playing and some initial thoughts on Mansions of Madness from Fantasy Flight Games. The designers of Guards Guards from Z-Man Games will join us on the latest edition of The Game Plan. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Wow, that sounds like just a jam-packed show.
It is. It took me almost a minute to read.
I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
And welcome back. Did want to point out that the show, once again, is a bit late. For those of you who had visited thegaminggang.com, you no doubt ran across that my stepmom had passed away. So I was in Chicago, back and forth. And I did want to take a moment to just say thank you to the folks out there who had sent me the very kind emails and comments on the website. It is most definitely appreciated. But I am now settled back in Arizona, and we should have smooth sailing here on out. So just wanted to throw that out there and say a big thank you. All right, good. That's the show.
That's the show. The show is just a tease for, you know, the next show.
Yes, that's right. It's a teaser show. It's like a teaser trailer.
So, is it time for some news?
Yes, I believe so. Why don't we begin with some gaming news?
First thing I wanted to mention was Nurashima. Okay? There, I've mentioned it.
All right, moving right along.
You've played Nurashima Hex and some of its expansions. Well, not you. I haven't.
No, not me. I've played 51st State.
Right. I haven't even played 51st State, but it's
based... You didn't miss a whole lot.
Really?
Not in my opinion, no. Huh? Some people really like it. It wasn't a bad game, but I thought the production values of the game were not the greatest. Plus, it was missing components that were supposed to be in there. I haven't done a written review of it. But I would say it's probably about a 6.5 in my book.
I see. Well, I've been trying to personally get a hold of 51st State so I could try it. And I was interested in the whole, you know, every game that comes out that says Nurashima Hex or Nurashima Hex Duels or 51st State says based on the world of the Nurashima RPG.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, what the heck is the Nurashima role-playing game?
It's from Poland, I know that. It's like post-apocalyptic? Yes.
It is the post-apocalyptic role-playing game from Poland.
Didn't we just say that? Is there an echo in here?
Is there an echo in here? Along the lines of Fallout, Mad Max, Terminator, which, hey, I'm all for. So I was interested in finding out more about the role play, the game that's this is all based on. And the problem is that Portal, the publishing company, they're in Poland and it's only available in Polish.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike all the board games that have been lovingly translated in English so us Yanks can share in the fun.
As far as I know, there's three games based on the property.
Yes. Which I mentioned. What is there, an echo?
Well, you said all the games. There's three. You made it out as if there's
thousands.
You know, hundreds of games out there based on this Nurashima property. I don't know why you're so hung up on this game.
I don't know. It's because I can't get it.
It's an obsession.
It is. Hey, I mentioned one post and I mentioned it on the show. Come on. That's an obsession.
And you talk about it on the phone every time I speak with you.
Nurashima. So they've been working on it for a couple of years and nothing has happened. Yet I actually wrote to the guy and said, hey, are you guys thinking about translating this into English? I got a response saying no. Well, okay, I guess we're just screwed. Oh,
was
well.
It no or was it no in Polish?
No, it was no.
Yet.
Is that Polish? Isn't that Russian?
I don't know. Well, the Russians ran Poland. Yeah, why not? I don't know.
There you go. So how about one of those P500 companies working out a deal, or Z-Man, who published Nurashima Hex? or somebody translating it into English so the rest of us can share in the fun. Just a thought. I may have to go back to like trying Marvel Project or even
Twilight 2000. Remember that game?
No.
That was GDW.
I'm thinking Traveler when you say Twilight.
Right. Same company, but we're talking years later. Twilight 2000. You were members of the military.
Oh.
So remember that?
Wait. Oh, yeah, I'm getting it confused with Marvel Project, which was kind of the same thing.
Well, Marvel Project, it was also post-apocalyptic, but you had been frozen cryogenically.
Ah, okay.
And you were supposed to emerge at, you know, like 50 years after a nuclear holocaust, and there's a screw-up, and it's actually hundreds of years later. It's been
right.
A long time.
Makes me think of the beginning of Buck Rogers, the TV show, with, you know, what's his name, spinning in space as time goes
Gil
by.
Gil Gerard?
Yes.
Bitty, 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 Buck.
That was a fun game. And then you'd have, like, these caches of stuff that was
hidden. Buck Rogers?
Yeah, Buck Rogers. In the 24th and a half century.
I didn't say Duck Rogers. I said Buck Rogers.
Oh, sorry.
That's Duck Dodgers, by the way.
Duck Dodgers, yes.
Yep.
That's my request in the news, is to have somebody translate this game into English, basically for me. There's other just people. There's lots of people who've requested it, just so you know. It's not just...
Wouldn't you just be better served to learn Polish?
Yeah, I'm going to run out and do that.
Twilight 2000 was supposed to be... I don't remember if it was... It wasn't really nuclear apocalypse, but it was like World War III, and then everything had gone down the tubes. So it was supposed to be the year 2000. I think the game came out probably around 1985 or so,
yeah,
if memory serves.
Okay.
And it was a much more like military-themed kind of game. And a lot of the adventures in that, interestingly enough, that were published mm-hmm. were in Poland. So they had like a Krakow source book and things like that. I don't know if you ever played it.
I don't remember.
I know I had all books in that. But we'll actually discuss some role-playing a little later in the show. I wanted to mention, as far as those fans out there who have not had an opportunity yet to purchase Dominion, Rio Grande is going to release a big box version of what is most people's favorite deck building game. Not mine, but most people's. The Dominion big box is going to contain Dominion, the base game, of course, Alchemy, which, oh, I know you loved, Elliot.
They must be trying to get rid of the cards. I don't know.
You didn't care for that one, did you?
No.
So you're going to get, like that, no. You're going to get Dominion, Alchemy, and the latest expansion, Prosperity, all for $100.
$100.
That's going to be the manufactured suggested retail price is $100 for the Dominion big box.
I see.
Along the lines of the Carcassonne big box.
Yes.
I have the Carcassonne big box too.
The return of Carcassonne big box.
That's right. Now Rio Grande is on big box 3. Because they'll swap out what's in there. Because Carcassonne is another game that maybe should have the title changed to Dead Horse.
And they keep beating it? I understand. Carcassonne's a lot of fun. I haven't played any of the expansions. I mean, there's so many of them out there. It's a fun game. I enjoy it.
Most of the expansions are just little things that are added to it. Not even a page of rules
like counters
for various meeples. Yeah, different meeples that you'll add, different twists, different tiles that'll be added in the game. So it's nothing huge, nothing drastic. There's a few that really change the game quite a bit, but most people don't play with all that many of the expansions, to be very honest. Sorry, Rio Grande. Next.
I don't have any more news. I don't want to talk about any more news. I want to get into the meat of the show.
You're like, should we get right into the news? Yeah. Okay, I've got one piece of news.
Which wasn't really even news.
Wow. The listeners out there are like, oh, thank goodness. We have a new show. We've had to wait, what, 3 weeks for it? And
on the edges of their seats.
Two pieces of news.
Hey, you know, Wizards of the Coast will be releasing Conquest of Narrath. The new Conquest of Narrath?
My what?
The new D&D universe-based board game this June, just in time for Origins.
Thank goodness.
Designed by Richard Baker, Mons Johnson, and Peter Lee for 2 to 4 players. War has come to the Dungeons & Dragons world. In the north, the undead legions of the Dark Empire of Kargoth march against the fragile League of Narrath, determined to sweep away the human kingdoms forever. To the south, the infernal Iron Circle launches its own goblin hordes in a campaign of conquest against the elves and corsairs of Valen.
It was going good. You just moved. Well, you did kind of stumble a little bit on one of the words there. Infamous or something, I forget. It was a word with an I, because you're like, yeah. Wow, that sounded really exciting. And I'm sitting here right now, and I'm going to jump online. I'm going to take a look to see exactly where I could pre-order this wonderful game, whatever the hell it's called.
Conquest of Narrath, coming soon.
Hey, what? My what?
252 plastic playing pieces, representing the champions and armies of the North, Kharkoth, the Iron Circle, and Valen. Looks interesting, actually.
Van Halen?
Van Halen is in the game. It's not bad.
I have to be honest, I just recently received Castle Ravenloft, so I am going to check that out.
Yeah, I don't have it. I don't have Castle Ravenloft. I haven't played any of the new Wizard board games. Castle Ravenloft, what they released, Shards of A Shardalon? Shreds of a Shardalon? Anyway.
Tell you one thing. I was taking a look at the figures. Now, I haven't really gotten to delve into the game too much, but the figures look pretty nice.
Oh, that's excellent.
I think I'll be curing them and then painting them, because they're made of that plastic that's kind of, it's not
tasty.
Real rigid. No, it tastes just fine. It's just not rigid. So if you were to prime them and paint them,
all the paint would break off?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So,
is that a problem? Let's talk painting miniatures here for a second. I have an entire box of Mansions of Madness miniatures that I would really like to see painted to add to the enjoyment of the game. But they're all flexible. You can't really paint flexible miniatures? Well, I guess you can. It's just more difficult.
You could if they were made in China or something. A lot of the pre-painted miniatures that are plastic, they're similar kind of plastic. So the paint that's used is almost like a rubberized paint, so it doesn't just peel off or crumble off.
I see.
It's interesting that you mentioned the figures for Mansions of Madness, because I was going to offer to paint those for you.
Oh, ooh, yes. Yes, very much so.
Ooh, a piece of candy. Ooh, a piece of candy.
Yeah, especially the monsters. That would be
If you're gonna paint some, you gotta paint them all.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, desperately. As we'll talk about a little later on, I'm really into moving Mansion of the Madness into more thematic experience as much as possible.
I'm waiting for that segment with bated breath.
Thanks.
I know.
Along the same lines, you were going to talk about Call of Cthulhu?
Can I finish my news? Can I finish
can
my
I
news,
finish?
Please?
Can I finish?
Can I finish it yet?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Those of you who missed out on the first printing of Alien Frontiers, rejoice, because you should be able to find it in stores starting on Friday, April 22nd. So the second printing will be available for the Tori Neiman-designed Clever Mojo game. And those of you who sat there whining and complaining that they didn't have an opportunity to get their hands on it the first time, you can stop whining and complaining.
I am happy for them. That's good news. I don't have it.
No, you're not happy for them. You already have the game. You never wanted to see another printing come out because that way your game would be that much more valuable.
Right. So we destroyed the company in order to increase the worth of the existing.
The rarity. Right. Yes.
Like, kill it.
We have gone and bought up every copy of Alien Frontiers we could get our hands on and burned them.
Burn them all.
It's sort of like Lex Luthor's plan in Superman to drop California into the ocean so that his Arizona property would go up in value.
Right away, Mr. Luthor. That's my Ned Beatty for it.
It wasn't too bad.
Are we done with this?
Couple
news?
Of last pieces.
Oh, sorry.
No. Gosh. Damn, you got a bee in your bonnet already. You start off by complaining that Hiroshima is not available in English. And then you're like, are we done with the news? Are we finished? Can we move on? Can we talk about what I want to talk about? I did want to mention the passing of Jolly and Barbara Blackburn's daughter, Amber. That happened the end of March. And those of you who go to Board Game Geek, or those of you who heard about it and went to Board Game Geek for the first time, there was an auction that took place to help the family out. Those of you out there who don't know who Jolly Blackburn is, if I mention Knights of the Dinner Table right there, you'll know that's Jolly. He was also the publisher of Shadus Magazine. So those of you out there who have been role-playing for quite a long time will remember that magazine. And he was also one of the founding members of one of our favorite companies, AEG. And I did want to mention in the auction that they had, people were putting various different items up. And AEG just had some really amazing stuff that they put out there. One was for representatives of the company to go anywhere in the world to present, I believe it was Legends of the Five Rings collectible card game. Yeah. Last I saw, I think it was a, because I haven't looked at the auction, and the auction is over. It was over on the 10th, but there were like bids for $2,000 from like a store in Greece. I mean, it was pretty amazing. Another item that they put up for auction was to have yourself in the Legends of the Five Rings game as a card.
Huh.
Yeah, there were some really, really awesome things that AEG put out there. And I really do hope that with everybody, you know, bidding on items and things like that. I personally won Duel of Ages, you know, the base game and then the expansion. Mm-hmm. So I'll be looking forward to receiving that. And then I just wanted to say, I really hope that the gamers out there in the community really came together. And it looks like they put together an awesome auction, and they brought in a lot of money for the family. So I thought that was very, very cool.
It's a very sad story.
It is. But, you know, what can you do? You know? That is life, my friend. Just kind of puts things in perspective, you know? My opinion, and I believe Elliot and I both agree on this because we've kind of mentioned this before, to us, the appeal of gaming isn't necessarily the game. The appeal of gaming is the friendships and just the fun that you have with your family and your friends and even strangers when you go to conventions and things like that, and the great relationships and the wonderful community that gaming creates and gaming has.
GFL, gamer for life.
You're like, no, I disagree.
I hate them. I hate the peasants.
It's all about the game. Well, there are gamers out there who it really is. It's all about the game.
That happens with anything, though.
Think of our experiences with Magic the Gathering tournaments, and I think right there that sums up
exactly
that class of gamer. Oh, by the way, I'm going to destroy you in 12 seconds and I have a razor in my shoe.
He's got a razor in his shoe and he's bad.
Leroy Brown. Yeah, you played that guy in Magic.
I did.
Yeah, you were playing him in the Magic tournament. I was off to the side pulling on Superman's cape. Spitting in the wind. And then I saw the Lone Ranger come walking past, and I just yanked that mask right off his face. I know.
Problem is, instead of shooting you, he started crying. Of course, he was only 7.
Yeah, but Tonto did a number on me, and I still have a hard time getting around after that. My last bit of gaming news is about one of my all-time favorite games. I do believe, I think it's probably one of Elliot's favorites, too. 2011 marks the 30th anniversary of the release of the Call of Cthulhu RPG. And to celebrate this date, Chaosium is going to offer a special binding of the 6th edition of the Call of Cthulhu rulebook. It's a 320-page book featuring thick leatherette hardcovers.
I love the leatherette.
And they had a couple of good songs. Don't get too worked up.
Pinky Tuscadero.
Oh my God, that's right. It was the leatherettes, yes. Wasn't it?
All right, I'm
moving right along. Yes, the interior pages are going to be printed on matte art paper. The binding is thread sewn, square backed. Each book is going to be individually shrink wrapped, and the barcode will be stickered onto the wrapping so it will not mar the book cover. So it looks like this is going to be pretty awesome. Now, those of you who aren't familiar with Call of Cthulhu, it's a classic role-playing game from Chaosium. I believe the retail price on that is going to be, I think I saw it's like $64.95.
It sounds really cool. This is probably my favorite role-playing game. Not that we've played in, however many years, but this was my favorite game that we ever played was Call of Cthulhu.
It's probably, I would think it's maybe been, 5 years since we actually played a game of it? Maybe a little bit longer than that.
Really? That's it?
7.
Okay.
I know I ran it for nearly 20.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
And the funny thing is, I can still remember the day I bought the first edition of Call of Cthulhu. I can't say that for many games that I've purchased throughout the years, but I can still remember not the exact date, but I do remember like the details of when I purchased Call of Cthulhu. I remember where I got it. It was me hanging out by myself. It's pretty funny how that can happen too.
Yeah.
So if you are a role-playing fan, you will definitely want to pick up Call of Cthulhu. It will have one print run, and that will be it.
Nice. Man, I'm tempted to buy it, even though I've never run it. You know,
right.
Just to have it.
Just to right. Have it, exactly. No, I completely understand. So there you have it. There is our really skewed news segment for this time around. I have to point out that this show is a lot more loosey-goosey than we usually are, which we're pretty loose anyway to start off with. But simply because I had just gotten back from Chicago, things have been crazy. I know, Elliot, you've been really busy too, so.
Not really.
We haven't been able to prepare.
I've been sitting around. Yeah.
I've been sleeping a lot. Sleeping, watching Rocky Horror Picture Show with the kids. Yeah, that's it. I was eating a lot of pizza too. Sleeping, pizza, Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's all good. This time around, Elliot took on the interviewing duties.
Yeah, I'll get better.
Was it fun? Did you enjoy it?
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. I got to talk to these guys. You know, it takes a while to get past the I'm the interviewer mode and into, actually having conversations with them.
Well, it's not like you're Mike Wallace.
Hello, I'm Mike Wallace. And you're on the game
plan. So, it's not as if you're popping out, you're exposing them for wrongdoing.
I know, but that's what I was going for. And yet I couldn't.
You were going for the hard edge investigative journalism.
Right. And instead we ended up just talking about games.
Elliot speaks with David Brayshaw and Leonard Boyd, who are the designers of the upcoming Z-Man Games release, Guards Guards, which is based on the Discworld series from Sir Terry Pratchett.
I'm talking with David Brayshaw and Leonard Boyd from Baxmental Games, who were kind enough to come online and tell us a little bit about their game coming out, Guards Guards. How are you gentlemen doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Doing well.
Excellent. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourselves?
Yeah. Okay. Well, say, I suppose in back in the 80s and stuff, we started playing different board games and a lot of role-playing games back then, like Runes and Rifts and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And that. Then there was a few of us started getting into the Terry Pratchett books then, and we all started reading those and following those. And we'd been playing some of the earlier board games back then, like Hero Quest and Advanced Hero Quest and stuff like that. So that sort of got us into gaming. And then I started working freelance for a while, so I had a bit of spare time on my hands and started playing around with an idea of creating a Discworld board game.
Mm-hmm.
And then David sort of came on board a short while after that.
Me? Well, basically, I'd been playing, I suppose, Hero Quest for a few years with friends. And a relative said, well, you know, Leonard plays that game as well. He has lots of little figures, but they're not all painted like yours. So needless to say, we got together and you know, the role-playing and the various gaming went on from there. And as Leonard said, we created a lot back in the 90s. I think I did a research project that lasted maybe, I don't know, 4 months in the public records office and created a whole scenario on Irish myths and legends and built the giant causeway out of egg boxes. So, you know, we're pretty imaginative, I think. Back then, you know, and, you know, young, free, single, and no children on our hands. So, you know, lots of time right. to create stuff.
Right, right. So how did you guys end up hooking up with Terry Pratchett and putting together Guards Guards?
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of a story. Back in 1995, Leonard took the board game to a bookshop in Belfast and showed it to Terry. And he said, do you know, to be honest, that's probably one of the best games I've seen at this time based on my books. So that was very exciting for us.
Right.
Back in 1995. And we tried then through the local, you know, development government agencies to get some funding to try to put this board game on the map. And we contacted people like MB Games and Waddington's and everybody. And basically they all said, oh no, we do our own research and development. And you know, we do this and we do that, and there's no money for stuff like that. So, you know, nobody really wanted to know. So some 8 years later, due to a quirk or meeting the wrong person at the right time or the right person, through the Green Games Company, mm-hmm. on the phone, their managing director said to me, look, David, this sounds like a really good game. The game industry is now, you know, 20 times what it was back then. I think you should really pursue this game and see if somebody will take it on board now. So based on that, I went round the houses a little bit with different people and ended up with a guy called Alex from Astevium Games. And Alex pointed us towards various you know, managing directors and presidents of board game companies all around sort of the UK and the States and different places. But we tried them one at a time to give them, you know, a fair due, let them see one at a time and they can make a decision.
Uh-huh.
So on the back of that in 2009, we were told by one of the American chaps that he thought our game was really good. He'd be very interested in it. And if we flew to Essen, to Spiel, you know, we'd be very keen to look at the game and we could maybe do business. So we flew over and we waited for whatever, half an hour for him outside his little tent. We went in, showed him the game, and he said, "You know, guys, I love the artwork. I love the story. I love the cards. I love this. I love that. But it's not the sort of game I do. Thanks for coming."
Oh, geez.
So we stood in Dusseldorf, like waiting on the firing squad for 5 minutes outside the tent. And I said, "Well, Leonard, look, you know," as I picked him off the floor, right. "We're in the biggest toy fair in the world here. You know, let's take our game around the toy fair, this prototype, and show it to a few people." So after walking the best part of, I suppose, 25 miles in a day, meeting various companies, we again hooked up with Alex from Stevium Games, who pointed us towards a couple of companies, Fred Games and Zeman Games. And they took a look at the prototype. We got it sent off when we returned to Ireland. And they both were quite interested in it, but they all came back with the same sort of comment, which would like it to be more a hobby game than a fun game. There was too much take that in it, as opposed to the pop group, but too much, you know, instant, we throw a dice and you're out of the game sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So it was very built based maybe on the Northern Ireland culture of experience and troubles and trying to laugh things off, I think. Uh-huh. So it was redesigned, and we did 5 redesigns in a year and a half to make it into a hobby game. That was kind of tough. We tore up many a board and threw it in the bin with all the artwork. But anyway, you've got to do these things to make it a success. So then we went back to Zeman and Fred and that, and I think Cosmos looked at it as well a couple of times, and they sort of were interested in it and then decided to do their own thing. But Zev from Z-Man said, "You know, guys, I think it's got potential. I think I'd like to be part of this." And he got some Pratchett fans to test it out there or whatever, and they liked it. And, you know, we then just got it tested by Pratchett fans, obviously, in the UK through Terry Pratchett himself. And yes, really, we've moved forward since then. People liked it, so we went ahead and, you know, got it out there.
Wow. So this game has been 15 years in the making.
Yeah.
Wow. Very good.
Yeah,
I'd like to say the game we have now bears very little resemblance to what it was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good thing. It has developed a lot and changed a lot. I think we've ended up with something, as David said, Terry commissioned a series of playtests himself over in Wincanton in the UK this year. And they were all very, very positive. A lot of the Discworld fans really enjoyed it. So it just gave us the added bit of incentive to give us that final push and get it out there. So since that, we have brought on Stephen Blair to do the illustrations. And he's just coming to the end of that process now after 5 frantic months of illustrating over 90 characters from the Discworld books.
Wow.
So
we can anticipate all of our favorite Discworld characters making appearances in the game.
Yeah, I think they'll all be in there. There's characters from over 24 of Terry's books.
Excellent.
Brought in as the volunteers, which can be recruited by the players as they go through the game.
Can I add that with every card, that there's a little character, there's a little excerpt from taken from a book, you know, a quote, something funny that was said or something about the character.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
that's excellent.
There's a little bit of personality there. And, you know, so if you're bored waiting on someone who can't get the grips of the game, well, you can have a read at the character.
And they're so good. You know, I love all the Discworld novels. I've read them all. Really, really have enjoyed them. You know, they're funny. They're satirical. They have real world applications.
Yeah.
But yep. They're so good. Why don't you guys tell me a little bit about the game itself? Describe how the game works.
Well, I suppose we've had that question from a few people over the last month or two.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And really, I suppose, bottom line is it's a race. But again, the objective of the race is like the best Discworld objective, which is it's not just about the winning, it's about making other people lose. So, you know, you got to bear that in mind. You gotta apply different strategies. Basically, what happens is the spells of the Octavio, is that the right pronunciation? Octavio have escaped. So there's magic loose in the city. Well, as you know, when there's magic loose, anything can happen, which is probably appropriate for Discworld, maybe akin to a Color of Magic book. Mm-hmm. The City Watch, obviously, are tasked with, you know, bringing the city to right. So we're better then to bring in the players as a so-called City Watch guard. So I suppose if you were a real Pratchett fan, you could dress up and be a troll for a night or be a dwarf while you were playing the game.
Or a werewolf.
So basically you go about the city into various places and you recruit these Discworld characters. They all have different attributes. And what they do is they help you escort the spell back to the Unseen University, where you have to make various tests to get the spell in. Because, as everyone knows, the wizards don't just let the commoners enter the Unseen University.
Right.
So it's the basis is of that. The subplot to it is that in the Guards book, there was the Elucidated Brethren, Vibon Knight. Uh-huh. They are throughout the city characters, as you can imagine. They want to reinstate the monarchy, or let's say some sort of royal ruler. But to do that, they try to apply the power of dragons. So throughout the game, players can either call a dragon or the Supreme Grandmaster on the turn of like fate cards can call the dragon. Either way, that involves serious interaction between players, which can be sort of cooperative gameplay or strategic gameplay. You may help your friend fight the dragon, or you might say, well, you're on your own, friend, sort of thing like that. Also, I suppose, in the game is the luggage. It's renowned through many of the Discworld books.
Yes.
The luggage is moving around the city on the recruitment of all the players. It has various routes it can take, but again, that is at the discretion of the player using the luggage and at that time. So if another player happens to be in the wrong part of the city as the luggage is trampling along, well, you know, the consequences are a bit inevitable there. So you can have friends for part of the game, and then you maybe change your friends for a later part of the game, depending on right. what you're after. There's a lot more in there besides that, really. But that's the main mix of it. Obviously, there's things in there like items, and there's things in there like magic and bits and bobs that players can use against each other. There's also a bit of combat as well, which is quite interesting, and let's say persuasion tactics. So in respect of a really difficult hobby game, it's probably not. In respect of a challenging hobby game with a bit of, you know, Pratchett fun in it, it's well in that sort of ilk. You know, it's a simple board game for children. It's okay. 4 12-year-olds play tested it recently for us and finished it in 2 hours, which is probably quicker than most of us can finish it. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it appeals from anyone, really, from about 11 or 12 up to, you know, the old Pratchett fans or, you know, guys in our ages, maybe older, you know.
You know, that's very good because one of the things I'm really big on is theme. And, you know, seeing a Terry Pratchett game coming out, really looking for the theme to be in there. And from what you've said and from what I read from Jeff's playtest that he did, it really, really, I'm looking forward to this game coming out. Now, how many players?
Well, you can play from 2 to 6 players, and sort of from ages 11 or 12 upwards, really. We've basically tried to keep the gameplay reasonably simple. I mean, all tests and attribute rolls, when you make, it's all done on one single roll. But that's basically to try and keep things moving in the game, because there's each player is tasked with returning 5 of the great spells. And to do that, they've got to move around the board. They're all hidden in different areas of the city. So to try and cut down on downtime for other players, we call it, you know, there's a lot of mechanics in there, but they're all very simple and all very quick to try and keep these things moving. We've also put in other things like the magic in the game can be used at any time. It doesn't have to be used on your turn. Which again keeps other players aware. When one player is trying to make their turn, other people can be sitting trying to figure out, have I got a spell or a scroll I can use against him? They've also got sneaky little guild abilities, which you actually can't use on your own turn. They can only be used on another player's turn if those players are careless enough to move within range. So again, it's something, even when it's not your turn, it's something you've got to be aware of, and it sort of tries to keep everybody on edge as the game goes through.
It's probably not a good idea to have too many beers. You will lose. You will miss quite a lot, I would think, because, as Leonard said there, you know, there's things that happen on the other person's turn. So you really have to concentrate a little bit, and then you can laugh a lot because you caught on to it. If you don't catch on, well, the joke's probably on you.
Right. So there is a lot of player interaction built into the game.
Yep.
And it's interesting that you have both the cooperative and the attacking each other aspect built into the same game.
Well, the attacking each other has to be done between the characters you recruit, because you can't have the city guild brawling on the streets of the city. So it has to be the street, and that's why you can only use your guild abilities on each other's character as opposed to their little recruited characters that they have.
Or, for example, summoning the dragon over a certain quadrant so that this player can't get there to get their spells, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. If you have your two spells, say, collected in a certain quadrant, well, you know, maybe the other three guys need to go there for a spell, and maybe you just might happen to summon a dragon, and, well, they can just go fight it while you go and get another spell. It comes down to that, making the other players lose.
Excellent. When are we looking at?
Well, as I say, we're just getting to the final stages with illustrations-wise. Stephen Player finished the last of the character illustrations just at the weekend there. I think he very kindly gave up most of his spring break to do that for us. Mm-hmm. I've been doing most of the other, or all of the other artworks myself, so everything else is ready, and it's gone over to Zev over in Zeman Games, who's now just giving a final proofing. And the target there is still to get it out for Origins.
Origins, yeah, in June.
Excellent.
The end of June. So
it's going to be released in Origins in the States, and then it will be in the Discworld Convention, North American Discworld Convention, where Stephen is a guest of honour. But it'll be released in the UK, hopefully at the same time, which is June. So it'll be UK and US in June, and I suppose anywhere else that really wants it, that speaks English and wants an English game.
We've actually, Pegasus in Germany have actually requested prototypes of us in the past few weeks, and they're looking towards producing a German language version of it as well to come out later in the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Nothing signed and sealed yet.
Of course.
They are interested, so.
So it'll be Herr Vimes as opposed to Mr. Captain Vimes, I suppose. You know, but I think the German audience are very into Discworld and that sort of medieval type humor as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think an important element is it's a mixture of strategy and fun, because you can't not have a Discworld game without some fun in it.
Oh, yes.
But you can't have a hobby game without some strategy in it. So it was probably why we had 5 redrafts. It was kind of hard to get that balance and then make sure the player interaction was there.
There is still a definite edge of the unexpected about the game. But as David says, it's a Discworld. It wouldn't be Ankh-Morpork if things were straightforward.
Oh, exactly. Yes. I think that'll be one of the things that I'll enjoy the most about it, is when the unexpected happens.
Yeah. Well, a thing we haven't mentioned, and I'll throw this in as well, there's a thing in it called the Pox. And to be honest, the Pox isn't really mentioned in Discworld books. Right. There are Pox doctors, but the actual Pox isn't actually talked about, like who has the Pox. But of course, if you do have the Pox, like all things, you know, it's made for sharing. And it can unfortunately inhibit your character, your opponent's charm, good looks, and maybe movement to have had to be shared the Pox with.
It is quite contagious that way, so it's just something else that players have to look out for.
A Pox on you. Yeah. Is there anything else you guys would like to add? What about your future plans?
Well, we're in the process here of getting a website up that we'll be selling the game online. So, I mean, Zeman Games will be selling it, and we'll be selling it, and probably in the States and here. If people, you know, customers buy the game off us, as opposed to some of the discount websites, and I know there's a few in the States, we'll probably do like a freebie with the game. We'll do something, you know, a little bit different, and like, you know, an illustrated bookmark or something like that. And it's, our website's going to be guardsguards.com. So we're going to do something like that, because we think, you know, we're going to have a lot more stuff on there about history and links and, you know, other products and bits and bobs, you know, so I think that would be nice.
as far as the game goes itself, we're drawing up a few ideas for an add-on if the game sells well, obviously. But what we've been talking about doing, rather than just bringing out extra cards and stuff, I want to bring, if there's a second add-on to this, I want to bring the game on a stage. This one is all about collecting 8 great spells and getting them back to the Unseen University. I would like the second edition of this will actually take the story on a little bit further. Obviously, as well, bringing in more characters and a few added rules here and there as well. But we'd like to continue the story rather than just replay the same story with more characters.
And at this point, the interview pretty much ended. Skype went down and was unable to resurrect itself. So I just wanted to say thank you to Leonard Boyd and David Brayshaw. And we'll be looking forward to seeing the Guards at Origins. Thanks, guys.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Just try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
I'd like to take a look at The Golden City, designed by Michael Schott. Originally released from Cosmos in Europe in 2009, it was made available here in the States from Z-Man Games back in 2010. The game's a nice choice to break out for new gamers who enjoy lighter, faster fare. It's for 3 to 4 players, ages 10 and up, and you'll attempt to build a network of connected buildings across 4 different types of terrain, which lead to the center of
the Golden City.
Since the board is broken up into sections, you'll see there's a traditional area control mechanic at work as you wind your way to the gates of the city and beyond. Play begins at the ports, and you build businesses along the paths outside the city. After a while, players will enter the city and continue laying down businesses until they hit the center. While you're doing this, you're going to score victory points, or what are called letters of business in the game, and obviously enough, the player with the most victory points at the end of the game is declared the winner. Once you get the hang of the rules, and it won't take but a few minutes to do so, a game should be played to completion within about 30 minutes or so, even with 4 players involved. The box states 60 minutes, but I just don't see that happening. Each round begins by turning over one of 16 scoring cards, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Then a number of landform cards, they're kind of like terrain cards, are drawn, and you place them in 2 rows, and they're side by side. The number of cards that you draw is going to be twice the number of players who are in the game. And these cards represent either ports or terrain types. First player is then going to place a hand counter. And I'm not kidding. It's a hand. It's a counter in the shape of a hand. And you lay it across 2 cards that are side by side in an attempt to claim them. Now the following players can either plop their hand on another unclaimed pair of cards or pay a cost in coins to outbid someone who's already made a claim. That cost increases the more times bids are made on cards in the round. Once the bids are completed and all the cards are claimed, it's time to take those cards and put them in your hand and move along to the next phase. So there's a bidding mechanic as well in the game. Mm-hmm. In the next phase, players place up to 2 buildings on the board, and they may not even place a building if they choose not to or don't have appropriate cards. And it starts with the first player and moves clockwise around the table. To build on a port, you have to have a port card in your possession. To build outside of the city or in one of the 2 outer rings of the city, you have to play 2 matching landform cards which show the appropriate terrain type of the area the building is going to be located. You can also use 2 matching landform cards to equal a terrain type of your choosing, so it allows you to build a building at the cost of 3 cards. The only limitation you have when you're placing buildings is you have to directly trace a path to a building you've previously built. Outside the city, each area can only contain 1 building, but once you enter the city gates, each segment can contain multiple buildings, but each player can only have 1 in that segment. So now we see that there's a set collecting mechanic to the game as well. There's also bonuses. Now, depending on where you've placed your building, each one of those locations has a bonus, and that bonus could be extra coins, goods, an extra landform card, a special bonus card, or an all-important key. Keys are really important because there are only six in the game, and you can't place a building in the center of the city until you use a key to unlock the area. The special bonus card simply adds some additional victory points at the end of the game. Once everyone's finished placing buildings, or choosing not to place buildings, you move on to the scoring round. That scoring card that you flipped at the beginning of the turn is going to show two goals for the round, which provide victory points to those players who have managed to fulfill either or both of those goals. Players also receive victory points for being the first or second player to place a building in a section of the city. So to give you an example, if you're the first person to build in the center of the city, then you get 10 victory points. That 10 victory points, that's a big swing. Play continues until either all the scoring cards have been played, so 16 turns, or a player has placed all of his buildings. Once that takes place, you finish the turn, and you tally the victory points, or letters of business, and the high score wins. Or if you're tied, the player with the most buildings in the Golden City earns the victory. As far as the components of the game, they're really nice, especially the game board. But there's one exception. I hate the cards. Not only are the cards kind of cheaply produced, but they're also that ticket-to-ride sort of size card. Mm-hmm. I have to ask, when are publishers going to realize that if the game isn't made for a six-year-old, don't design the card for a six-year-old's hands? Now, I don't have huge hands. I have fairly small hands. And before anybody out there starts thinking, "Ooh, yeah, you know what they say about men with small hands," let me point out I have big feet.
Yes, it's always important to point that out.
That's right. So it evens out. Okay, so leave it at that. Personally, I think the Golden City is a really fun game. You have to have three or four players. There is a variant that was written by the designer of the game where you can play it with two. One thing that it seems to me, if you're playing with three players, it doesn't seem like there's enough competition for the cards and for placing the buildings. I would say it would be perfect with four. It's a lot of fun. So it's along the lines of a game like a Carcassonne or a Ticket to Ride as a gateway game to be able to introduce your non-gaming friends to the world of gaming.
Actually, it's good. I'm always on the lookout for those type of games.
Now, the retail price, the manufactured retail price on the game is, I think, like $54.95. $54.95 is a pretty hefty price for what I consider to be a gateway game, an introductory game. You can get it for a bit less at various retailers out there online. And, you know, even though I do understand that we are affiliated with Noble Knight Games, I did want to point out that I got my copy brand new from toysforthought.com for $14.95. It was one of their bargain games. And I just wanted to just send out a quick shout out to Mike from Toys for Thought. I placed an order with them. It was about $150. And at $150, your shipping is free. I got seven games that they had in their bargain section, and they came right away. They were packaged very nicely. Everything was perfect. So even though we are affiliated with Noble Knight Games, and we do hope that you do actually patronize their website because it helps us out, I did want to point out from time to time, take a look at what specials are going on at Toys for Thought, because you can score some really great games at fantastic prices if they have it in their bargain section.
Yeah, but nobody go until after I've finished my order. Oh, I got a couple of days before this comes out.
Well, there you go. So
somehow
jump on that.
Was sold out.
I can't understand it. Well, they had Campaign Manager 2008, which I'd really like to get because I heard it's a really cool game, and they had it for like $12.95 or $14.95, something like that. But even when I got there, it was sold out. It was out of stock.
That's bogus.
As everyone knows, the War Room is sponsored by Victory Point Games. And their latest release is the first of their two proposed Alamo-themed games. This one is A Blood Red Banner, The Alamo. It's Battle Lesson game number 9. A Blood Red Banner is a solitaire Battle Lesson siege game where you, as the Texian heroes, must survive the attacks from the relentless Mexican army and save the walls of the Alamo. This historically based game is easy and fast-paced, providing the air of challenge that occurred between both armies all those years ago. Playing time is approximately 15 minutes, which is about how long the Texians held out, isn't it? Oh, I kid. Remember the Alamo.
Texians?
Yeah, Texians.
I've never heard of them referred to as Texians. Texans?
No, they were, at the time, they were referred as Texians.
Oh, okay. So you're talking to our listeners who are from 100 years ago.
No, I'm talking to our listeners who have some kind of conception of history.
Knowledge. Oh, sorry.
It's March 1836 when the Texians are fighting for their new republic. As the besieged Texian defenders, you must fight off the 5 converging Mexican attack columns that are making their way towards the Alamo. Direct brave counterattacks, pushing back the troops of the Mexican dictator, General Santa Anna, before they storm the walls and cut into the heart of the Alamo. Do you have what it takes to withstand the siege? Defend the Alamo and wave your flag of victory in a blood red banner. Available at victorypointgames.com, where the gameplay is the thing. Wise guy, so, Texians, I got it.
Texians.
Watch John Wayne in the Alamo. Huh? Watch that. Because, you know, if John Wayne made a movie about it, it's true.
Yeah, I agree. No complaint there.
I mean, just look how we won Vietnam. I mean, come on.
Fearless men who jump and die.
That's not the Alamo.
Men who fight by night and day. The brave men. You just mentioned John Wayne in Vietnam, didn't you?
Yeah.
Of the Green Beret. Wasn't that Vietnam?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
Mid-60s Vietnam. Why are you laughing?
I remember mid-60s Vietnam.
No, I'm just saying that it was early 60s Vietnam, mid-60s Vietnam, back before Walter Cronkite said, got to be honest, I'm here on the news, and we're not going to win this thing.
I'm going to talk about Final Frontier from Victory Point Games, designed by Tom Decker, and it came out in 2010. It's for 2 to 4 players, ages 10 and up. Take a little less than an hour or a little more than an hour to play the game.
Well, which is it? Is it less or more?
It depends on the number of players.
Ah, thank you.
No problem. And, you know, I think every game company should have some kind of Star Trek copyright quotes around that type game and its repertoire.
Would that be Star Trek-ish?
Yes, Star Trek-ish.
Tarstek-ish?
I'm a big Star Trek fan.
Yes.
As you well know.
I know that.
And Final Frontier seems to be VPG's homage to the original series without actually mentioning anything copyrighted, kind of like how Starfleet Battles was when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
It's an outer space adventure game. The goal is to complete missions and to earn victory points. The player with the most victory points when the final challenge card is overcome is the winner. Starting out the game, right, you need a crew.
I would think.
And it comes in handy. It's a mission-based type game. Okay, so you're completing episodes or missions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more original series themed. Okay, it's got a little board with various mission tracks on it, and it has a deck of cards where you select your crew members.
All right, let's jump right to the point. Let's jump to the question about this game that every one of our red-blooded male listeners is thinking. Do you get to make out with hot, green-skinned alien chicks?
No. I'm sorry, you don't.
Fine.
There is. It's not that, quite that mission-based. The rules cover both a basic game, which is like academy training, and then there's the advanced game, which is supposed to be the 5-year mission.
Mm-hmm.
I went straight to the 5-year mission, just because that's what I wanted to do.
Of course. An expert in all things Trek like yourself?
Exactly.
You wouldn't even need the real Starfleet Academy. You'd be like, hey, I understand if you don't give me my own ship, but yeah, first officer, yeah, easy. Done.
Each player gets 7 crew cards, which are grouped by icon shapes in the basic game, but are dealt out randomly in the advanced game. Players then select a captain, a first officer, a medic, an engineer, a red shirt, and 2 ensigns.
Don't forget the red shirt.
Yes, your generic guy who...
Your cannon fodder. Right.
Right. And each of the cards has 4 stats on it, which strength, intelligence, willpower, and dexterity that vary from card to card. Then there's the challenge deck, which you shuffle up, and the space anomaly card, which is a card that ends the game, is placed somewhere in the final 6 cards. So when you draw that card, the game's over. After you select your crew and the cards are shuffled and the board is set up with the various mission counters and player tokens, you're set to go. Each turn, the players determine what type of mission will be attempted, and what they have is they've got 4 choices that have to be made, and each player makes 1 choice in a 4-player game.
Mm-hmm.
In less than 4 players, of course, you have to make multiple choices. Basically, it's, okay, what type of mission are you going on? It's either going to be deep space or planetary-based. You're going to choose whether it's going to be a hostile-type mission or an exploratory-type mission. You have to choose whether you're just going to send 1 crew member or 2 crew members. And you have to choose which crew member has to be on the mission, whether it's going to be your captain, your first officer, your medic, or your engineer.
Mm-hmm.
After you set all that up and select that, then you flip over the mission card. And it's just a deck of, and they're called challenge cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a deck of cards. On each card, there's each of the 4 types of missions listed. It gives like a sentence saying what the mission is, less than a sentence, like navigate asteroid belt.
That's a sentence.
Remove trog infiltration.
That's a sentence.
That's a sentence. It's very short. But, and then it tells you what stat is required for this mission,
mm-hmm.
and whether it's 1 person on the mission, what number you have to reach, status number they call it, you have to reach for 1 person on the mission, or if it's a 2-person mission, what number you have to reach for that. So in a 1 crew mission, you would have to overcome a score of 8. In a 2 crew mission, you would have to overcome a score of 15. And all you do is you add up the totals for the crew members for that particular...
attribute.
Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Attribute.
Yeah.
So you got to beat an 8 dexterity, right? You look at your card. He's got a 7. Then you roll 1. You get to roll 1 die and you add it to that score.
Mm-hmm.
If you get higher than 8, it has to be higher. If you get higher than 8, you complete the mission. Okay, so you move along your little counter along the mission track, 1 box, and that mission is completed for you. You've completed that challenge card.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do it, then you're failing the mission. You get to roll the die 1 more time and add that to it. If you still don't roll over that number or get higher than that
status
challenge
number, right,
then your crew member... one of your crew members, or the only one on the mission, dies.
Must
They're toast.
Die.
Yes. If you do roll over it, then you didn't complete the mission, but they both survive. If you successfully complete the mission, the person who had the highest score in completing the mission, they're the mission, like, super guy for that turn, super
that,
player for that turn.
Is that, I was going to say, is that the term that's utilized in the game, super player?
Super player. The challenge winner, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You get to do an extra thing. Like you can move an extra box along the mission track. Or you can take a +1 victory point token. Or you can take a +1 skill token and toss that on your one of your crew members. So they get +1 to all of their skills.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually accumulate those through the game. So you can end up with really super crew members if they don't die.
Right.
You know, beforehand. These are the basic missions that you start with. And once you go through, say, 4 of them, depending on which track you're moving along, because there's 4 simultaneous tracks, and as you move along these 4 different tracks, eventually you hit the mission complete box once you get through enough challenge cards. And once that's complete, you either take a victory point token, and their value goes down as the victory point tokens get taken. Like the first one on top, the first player to complete that whole deep space hostile mission track gets 6 points. The next player would only get 3 points. The next one would get one. But you can also...
And player four is SOL.
Exactly. Player four might as well give it up for that track. But there are four tracks. And you can also decide to go on an advance mission. And an advance mission is basically another stack of tokens that you claim. And instead of using the challenge card to complete a certain mission, you instead go by the special requirements that are on each token. And you get bonus victory points for completing one of the advance missions. And again, you can also take a plus one victory point or a plus one stat token. And it's really a very simple game. I had a lot of fun playing it.
I think it's a fun game too. I enjoyed the game.
There's a couple things I would like to have, you know, since I'm playing the game. Yeah, but you know how I am. I wanted my own customizable crew member cards.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just cards basically with four stats listed on them, right? With a little illustration.
Right.
I'd like to have a card that I could, say, roll 1d6 plus 12 or something like that to split up as you see fit,
mm-hmm.
you know, in all the different stats on the card. And then a space where you could put in a name. So I could create Captain Miller.
I'd like, and that would be like ones all across the board?
Right. One. Dex one. I would also like to see where you could accumulate... You know, if they survive the mission, you can say the winner of the game gets to roll 1d6 and gets this many stat points to split up.
Ooh, that's
among his surviving crew members.
Something
like that.
I would think 1 point. Well, now you're creating kind of role-playing aspect to the game then.
Exactly. That's what... Remember in B17 where you mm-hmm. have all your crew your crew, and you'd like them to get better as they go along, and then you retire them. You'd have to retire these crew members once they survive so many missions. Otherwise, they hit this total of points. They have to retire. They get promoted to admiral or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it would add a little more for me. So I may just do that myself. You know, print out my own little cards and figure that out just to give it some play testing. See how that works out.
Sure.
But I really enjoyed the game. It was fun. It's light. It's mission-based, so it does give you a little feel for the show. You can throw your red shirt in there if you're worried that your one of your crew members is not going to come back from a mission because it turns out to be really difficult. You can substitute your red shirt in there and send him instead.
Before you roll.
Right, and yeah, of course they get killed. And then you have to promote one of your ensigns up to take his spot. Eventually they get killed because you do lose crew members. And eventually your ensigns will get killed and you'll have to start promoting civilians.
Yes. And in the advanced games, there's even relationships between crew members.
Yeah, they have like relationship tokens, like a super team, like two team members who have survived, you know, this many missions together. They'll get the bonus victory point tokens. And there's cards, event cards. There's a couple of event cards. Like you can say this crew member is jealous. So anytime this crew member has to go on a mission, this guy takes his place because he's jealous. Or there's friends or secret admirers. There's a lot of little stuff thrown in. Yeah, I had a lot of fun playing it. Right now it's on sale at the Victory Point Games website for $34.95.
And now it's time for Thoughts on Gaming with your hosts, Jeff and Elliot.
You had just mentioned adding a role-playing aspect to Final Frontier.
Yes.
I know you wanted to discuss Mansions of Madness.
It's true.
Role-playing aspects of that, I believe.
Yes. Well, you know, Mansions of Madness is designed to be a combination role-playing board game.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of... To be story-driven. It's got a lot of... flavor text in the game, as do all Fantasy Flight games, but this one's really story and event driven, where you start the game by reading the basic scenario premise to mm-hmm. the players.
The setup, yeah.
And I've only played it once, okay? So I'm not doing a review here. I just wanted to talk about my initial thoughts on it, basically.
You've played it once... with your own gaming
right.
gang, and you played it once at the Arkham Knights.
Yes, so I played it in total twice. Just once, me running it myself. And I'll admit, right off the bat, I made a lot of mistakes running it this time. I ran it for the kids. And of course, kids I'm talking.
Teens.
Teens and young adults.
Right.
I had a blast being the keeper in this game. I had an absolute blast. They were like, eh, it's okay. And then halfway through it, my daughter says, you know, why don't we play Dungeons & Dragons? And I haven't played Dungeons & Dragons. I can't remember the last time I played Dungeons & Dragons. They have. So I'm thinking as I'm, because I really want to play it again, and I want them to be excited about it and enjoy it as much as I did. So I started trolling the different forums to kind of see other people's reactions to it. And I, for the most part, I've seen that it's the keepers that are going on and they're saying, hey, this is a really great game. You know, let's get some more scenarios. Or they're looking to make it more role-playing rather than more board game-like. Because it, mm-hmm. it is a board game, you know?
Of course, right.
It's the keeper against the player. But the story-driven part was just so nice. But I wanted more. And I didn't come to the realization until this morning when I was going over some posts and I ran across a post that a guy did on the Fantasy Flight forums. And he gave descriptions for the first scenario. He gave descriptions for each and every room that's on the board in terms of the scenario. So as a player goes into the room,
you could add a bit more flavor to the game.
Exactly. He reads the description that's written out that goes along with the story. What happened was they walk into this mansion. They've got the basic premise of the story. And then they just start wandering around aimlessly trying to discover clues while I try to attack them and stop them from doing stuff.
So as a player, you can pull up in the van, Scooby and the gang jump out.
Right. Hmm, jinkies. And there's three clues that are hidden throughout the board. And the players wander around. There's all these little cards on the board so they can see where all these little cards are so they know what rooms to head toward. And you flip open over the card after you explore the room and it says, well, you see nothing of interest. Or you discover a shotgun. Or you discover a puzzle that you have to solve to get past this lock.
Or you run across a monster with a shotgun.
Then you discover a clue, which leads you to the next clue. And that's how it's supposed to proceed. Meanwhile, there's an event deck, which is basically five cards, that you put these little time tokens on it. And in each turn that goes by, you put another time token on it. Once you reach a certain number, you flip that card up and you read it. And it tells you what happens depending on what version of the scenario you're playing. So the players really only have a certain amount of turns, because that happens during the keeper's turn, that you put a token on each card. A certain amount of turns before the culmination, climax, before the climax
the orgasm
is reached. And if the players haven't discovered what the objective is yet, then you reveal the objective and tell them, well, you've got to find this dude and kill him before time runs out or something happens. And in this case, they had to find this guy, kill him, before the mansion collapsed on their heads and killed them all. And they did. They were able to successfully pull it off. But it bothered me that they were wandering around and really didn't know what the heck they were doing, or the story didn't seem to come out like it really should have. Like, there's a built-in where the guy's wife, who's dead, rises as a zombie.
Hey, don't give everybody, you know,
spoilers.
Yeah, don't spoil it for everybody out there who haven't played it or who haven't played that adventure.
Yeah.
So what I would be curious about, if you don't mind, is do you think that you had a much better time playing as the keeper because you knew what was going on in the story, you had an idea of what could happen, whereas the players, they just feel like they're just randomly bouncing around from room to room?
I think so. I really do. That's why this guy who gave the descriptions for every room, which was really, there's a paragraph for every room, and you go in and, you know, there's blood on this and you see this. And the game's supposed to be an exploration type story game where mm-hmm. you're going through a story. I think the room description is really added, and I'm going to try it. We'll add more to it. I can feel that I am searching for a role-playing game that is maybe a miniatures role-playing game. You know, I don't know, but that's what I was looking for. That's what they were looking for. But where the GM isn't just the omniscient being who controls everything, he's an actual player. And I think they can get there by publishing scenarios with more detail, more descriptions, more stories that you read at each point. I mean, I think this game is almost there. I mean, it's the way that it's going. I don't know when I'll get a chance to play Call of Cthulhu again with Jeff as the GM, which is the only way I would really want to play it. But I'm looking for a game that is a role-playing game that I get to take part in, not just be the omniscient being. It's almost there, and I think if they throw some more detail that the keeper can throw out at the players to give them more direction, to give them more hints, to give them more flavor, to give them more insight into that particular story, I think it would really help. The mechanics are all there, so you basically have a miniatures game with role-playing aspects. Now, I know the way it wasn't designed like that. It's designed to be a board game.
Right. You know? Exactly. Almost a storytelling board game.
Right. And it's almost there, and for what it is excellent. But I could sense that that's what they were looking for, and I've seen that a lot of keepers have expressed similar thoughts that, you know, they're looking for that one extra step. I don't know. What do you think? We played Android.
No, you and I have not played it, no. Okay. Together, no.
That's almost along the same lines, although that one had so many complexities in it that it was...
Yes, very true.
You know, I don't, very difficult.
I don't know. The way I sort of look at this, and I'll be the first one to say that we have discussed covering role-playing games in more depth, and we are going to. We're looking for some core rule systems that we'll talk about. We'll do reviews. I'll be the first one to say on the show, when we do talk about RPGs, we're not going to go into some boring rehash of, well, ran this session and this is what happened and things like that. Because to be very honest with you, I'm bored to tears whenever I hear people talking about their latest role-playing session, because it's no doubt in the retelling, it's never as entertaining as it was the first time around while playing.
Yes, that's very true.
I think what we're starting to see, and you know, we could kind of talk about what is the state of role playing right now, at least from our understanding, from what we're seeing, is a lot of the imagination. This is my opinion. This is all this is. But a lot of the imagination in role playing is being sucked out. From my understanding, the newest edition of Dungeons and Dragons is simply World of Warcraft as a role-playing game, where you have archetypes of characters. One guy's a tank, the other's a damage dealer, this one's a healer, this is the ranged magic user, this is the ranged, you know, archer, and things where when we grew up and we were role-playing and we role-played for over 20-some years, the characters were characters. They weren't archetypes.
Yes.
Now, granted, in Call of Cthulhu, you could have someone who was an author or someone who was a mechanic or a professor or a librarian or whatever, and you had some skills that you would start off with. But you always had the ability to branch out and flesh out your character. What I'm seeing, like I said, from my understanding, I've heard that the new edition of D&D or AD&D, whatever it's considered now, is just every game is just a dungeon crawl where it's go into the dungeon, kill stuff, get stuff, and leave. And a lot of the younger role players out there, that's how they play these games, from what I hear. Or it's just go in, rolling dice, smashing stuff up, killing things, take stuff with. I heard Gamma World is very card-driven. Don't know, haven't seen it. It's just what I've heard. Where in our day, you know, you would go and you'd pick up a scenario book or whatever, and it would, you know, it would give you a story. And when we played, and we could use Call of Cthulhu as the example, then when I was running it, it was the story. The story was number one. That was the main selling point.
Yes.
Everything else came second. It wasn't, oh gosh, what's the rule where if you fumble your attack, what happens to your weapon? Oh, hang on. Whoa, hey, time out, everybody. Hold on. Or, oh, you guys run across a couple of ghouls. Wait a second. I got to grab their stats. Hang on. If you remember, very, very rarely would I ever refer to any rule book or scenario book or anything like that, except for maybe if there was some sort of a handout clue, because Call of Cthulhu is very investigative.
Yes.
It wasn't like I sat there and went in and said, oh gosh, let me double check this role for what exactly does this spell do and blah, blah. No, because that interfered with the story and that takes you out of the story. It seems to me, and I'll use probably the greatest Call of Cthulhu campaign that we ever were involved with playing, Masks of Nyarlathotep.
Uh-huh.
They release Chaosium. Chaosium has released a 25th anniversary edition of that. Along with that, you can also purchase a companion book. I want to say it's over 500 pages of additional material for running that campaign. In our day, as someone who was the game master or whatever you want to call it, the keeper, you didn't have 500 pages of here's the motivation of the non-player characters and here's this and here's that. I think it's very cool that that's available today, but we had to use our imaginations. Today, role-playing games just, and somebody out there, please prove me wrong. And we want to cover role-playing games in some capacity at the Gaming Gang.
Right. But if I want to play WoW, I'll just go play WoW.
Exactly. And that's how I look at it, too. If I want to play a massive multiplayer online role-playing game, then you know what? I'm going to play that online.
It's true.
I think the RPGs have been dummied down. I think that everything has to be spelled out. Just like you were talking about how, now granted, not on the show here, but when we had talked the other day and you were telling me about running Mansions of Madness for the kids.
Uh-huh.
And like you said, we're talking young adults. We're not talking about 10-year-old children here. Everybody was getting up and they were on their cell phones and they were texting people. And I'll tell you what, when I was running a game of Call of Cthulhu for yourself and your nephew Paul Miller and Ed Ruprecht and anyone else who would get involved in the game with us, if we had that ability to text and to be on cell phones and things like that, it wouldn't have happened because the game was so engrossing. We made it an engrossing experience where we would play sometimes 3-4 times a week.
Yeah, that's true.
And I remember hanging out at your house and, you know, it'd be like the four of us and, come on, Jeff, you know, run some more CSC. Come on, run some more CFC. And it's like, oh, guys, I mean, I thought we were going to go hang out and meet girls and stuff. Ah, well, you know, we can do that later. It's only 2:00 in the afternoon. We'll play for like 3 hours. And then we would play and it would be midnight. And then we'd go jump in the car and we'd go over to Toots, which was like an ice cream fast food joint. And we would grab some food, come back, and go back to playing. And we would maybe play till 3:00 in the morning.
Yep, sure would.
I don't see that going on in role-playing now. I don't see that kind of engrossment now. And I'm not saying that people aren't engrossed by role-playing games today. But now it seems like people are more into, you know, dressing up as their characters and things like that, where we would have never considered something along those lines. No. Even going to a convention, we never even for 1 second fathomed dressing up as a character or something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you think about it, you're discussing how role-playing games are becoming less role-playing games, and I'm talking about wanting board games to move more towards the role-playing side. So it's like we're coming at the same point from two completely different angles. Yes.
Right.
You know,
you're seeing role-playing games becoming much more standardized, I guess would be a word I would use, or mechanized, or it's just a repetitive, oh, you need to do this, roll this die, you need to do this, roll this die, you need to do this, roll this die, and everything's the same. You know, oh, okay, well, you know, here's our team of mighty adventurers, and oh, okay, wow, there's a monster here, so I do this, you do this, he does that, she does that, and you all have your assigned roles of exactly what you're going to do each and every time, which is exactly what you would do in like something like World of Warcraft.
Right. Yes.
Where in the old days it was sort of like, okay, well, let's try this and let's go. All right, let's try this.
I'm going to run.
There was much more responsibility for the entertainment value of the game on the game master or the keeper than I think there is now.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And that's why I feel like all the keepers who are playing Mansions of Madness are going on there and saying, how can I make this better for the players? Because that's what they're looking to do. There's that want out there to be to provide this great playing experience and then just take part in it yourself. So it's an overall great gaming experience. And I know there's two different things we're talking about. We're talking about actual role-playing and then just something similar to role-playing.
But we're having a role-playing aspect to it. Yes.
Yeah. And I think there's space for both to exist, but you're right. I mean, the role-playing seems to be dumbing down, whereas meanwhile, the board gamers are wanting it to move up.
A good example, White Wolf, when they had, when Vampire was the rage and whatever the werewolf game was, they were all the rage. I had those core books that I read through. Never, I think I ran one game of Vampire the Masquerade and was like, nah.
Right.
Simply because it was kind of more style than substance. Now, I'm not saying role-playing is dead by any stretch of the imagination. It's nearly impossible for anybody to make money publishing role-playing games. They probably break even or make a few bucks. It's not like board gaming or other tabletop games. It seems to me that the imagination is gone, both with the players and with the keepers. Now, maybe it's because we have such information overload now where you just don't see that kind of ability for players to be able to, I'm not saying engross themselves. I'm not telling people that they need to go climb through the sewers pretending to be a dwarf.
Right.
But the whole aspect of, yeah, well, you know, we're just screwing around for a couple hours and then we're going to go drink some beers.
It's hitting that suspension of disbelief thing, getting as close exactly as you can to it.
And the person who runs the game, of course, and the players involved add a lot to it. But if you have a game master who's terrible, and we played many games with very, very horrible game masters, yeah, then that's a complete waste of time, too. So I do understand the kind of dummying down aspect to assist people in running an entertaining game. And when we talk about role-playing, you and I have probably either played or owned the rule sets to at least 100 RPGs over the years.
Yeah, it's true.
Because I know we were chatting on the phone the other day, and we were just running through this title, that title, this title, that title, this title, that title. And then after I got off the phone, I thought of about another dozen. And I would love to be able to run a campaign again. And that's one of the reasons why I'd like to take a look at some of the RPGs that are out there. And I can be very honest and tell our listeners that we're going to take a look at AEG's Legend of the Five Rings as one core set, where we want to take a look at that. I'm looking to contact Chaosium because I would really love to see where Call of Cthulhu is now.
Me too.
What they've done with that. Because the last time I saw the rules was 5th edition?
I don't know.
I think the last campaign setting that I took a peek at was at the mansion, or I'm sorry, at the Mountains of Madness that they had released. Uh-huh. I'm sure there's been a lot going on at Chaosium with Sea of Sea, and we refer to it as Sea of Sea. I know a lot of people out there, it's COC, but we've been calling it Sea of Sea for 30 years, so we're not going to stop now.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So I guess we'll... Go ahead.
I was going to say something similar, I think, to what you're about to say is I think it basically bears some more investigation. I mean, we're going to have to look into it and see where really the state of role-playing is at.
Exactly.
You know?
And I do want to point out for our listeners and people who visit the website, we're not going to become a role-playing website. Oh, okay. You know, that's not what we're talking about. We're branching out a little bit more. And, of course, we're always open to having more contributors join us on the website and on the podcast itself, since we no longer, unfortunately, have James Engelhart contributing to the site and the show. So we're always open. So if there's somebody out there who has an expansive background in role-playing games, like I would say Elliot and I both do, we'd love to hear from you, because we want to bring that kind of experience on board as well. So maybe we wouldn't have to focus, Elliot and I, on, you know, covering everything. We're going to start looking at some of the new miniatures games that are out there, because there's a few that look really interesting that I'd love to check out, because I'm a huge miniatures fan. Yeah. So as far as with role-playing games, I guess what I'm really looking at is I'm issuing a challenge to the role-playing game companies out there. Show me a game. And for our listeners and our visitors at the website, let us know too. Tell us what your role-playing games that you really enjoy are. I want to issue the challenge. Hey, show me that the imagination and the wonder of role-playing is still there.
You're still the one. Sorry.
You know, any time I ever heard that song, I always thought of ABC.
It's true.
Because it was, what, the mid-late 70s, and that was like their theme.
Yep.
For the network.
Yes, it was.
Still the one, blah, 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 blah. Still the one, blah, 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 blah. So there you have it. Role-playing gamers, role-playing game manufacturers, you tell us that we're wrong.
Tell him he's wrong.
Which wouldn't be the first time.
So I'll be exploring more of this Mansions of Madness quandary that I'm in. I may have to develop my own scenario.
I think the quandary that you're telling me that people are saying is the person who's running the game is having a great time, and everybody else sitting at the table, so-so.
Right. And, you know, I'm not saying that that is applicable in to everyone. It's just a subset out there of, you know, people who want a little more.
It's
my experience.
It's what you're, right. It's what you've been running across on forums.
Yeah. So, be interesting to see.
And we already know most people out there are more than happy to share their displeasure with the internet world as opposed to telling people how much they really like something.
Yeah. And, you know, I really do like it. I'm already thinking of somehow combining the Arkham Horror board with Mansions of Madness so players could move to, like, a location and then zoom into that location to the Mansions of Madness board. So you're walking through Arkham. Hey, I'm going to go to over here. Then you zoom in and you got this other board, and then you do your exploring in this one spot. Or a shop you can go in, or whatever. I don't know.
That's just insanity. Scenes. Insanity!
I'm telling you.
You, sir, are crazed. So I believe that's it for the show this time.
I think so.
I think so, too. Care to take us out?
All right.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard, or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek, or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. Our show notes are provided by James Englehart and can be found on our website. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.